This is Jeffrey Johnston, and I'm Aaron Shuffle-Waliff, and I'm an evangelical Christian. Jeff is a Mormon from what city in Arizona?
I'm outside of Phoenix here.
Outside of Phoenix. I'm in Orem, and Jeff and I interact lately more so on blogs, usually through Mormon Coffee, sometimes through the New Cool Thing. Why do you call it the new cool thing, and why do you spell it with an A?
Oh, actually, when I was at BYU in the early 90s, we had a band that we named Sam I Am, and it became somewhat popular in the time. It was a ska band, and it turns out we discovered that there are probably a band. There's probably in every state in the nation there is some garage band that named themselves Sam I Am. So we thought we were going to, of course, be rock stars. So we had to come up with a new name that would, that would be our thing that we wouldn't have to share with several thousand other bands. So that was the name that after we became somewhat established as Sam I Am of Provo, we realized we couldn't keep it forever. So we thought, all right, we played with other names. The New Cool Thing with an, if we not have done an E, but an A, sort of was the name we settled on, and we did one gig under that name and then gave up and went back to Sam I Am. But so that's how my blog got that name.
Cool. Well, I've really enjoyed Jeff's blog because it dives straightforward into theology. A lot of issues that I really don't see a lot of other people in the Bloggernacle talking about. So I have the blog on my Google Reader, RSS Reader, and I'm always making sure I can read whatever I can on it. And it's neat to see the other posters on it. And I've really enjoyed it. But lately, Jeff and I have been going back and forth on a lot of intense issues that seem like it seemed to me like it would be productive, constructive to just have a recorded phone chat here to hash out issues, talk about issues, ask questions, go back and forth. And I think it would be productive in a way that maybe a lot of blog conversations wouldn't be. And I know there's some pros and cons both ways, but anyway, yeah. Jeff, what are some of the beginning issues you think we can cover? We've gone over everything. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, maybe this latest, after asking all sorts of questions about some of the beliefs evangelicals have, and specifically Calvinist versions of evangelicals, I put up that recent post. Let's see, just in case people are listening later, that today is the
The advantages of
20th.
bad theology?
Yes, the advantages of bad theology, and so that probably went up. What's July 19th of
18th.
2007, the 18th. Okay, good, and so. And so I outlined there what I think are six or seven things that sort of apply to your theology. And I would be curious to see if any of those are straw men. I guess I could list them off. I think some of them are no-brainers for you to say, sure, yeah, it's us. One of them would be that God is uncreated and beginningless, and obviously everything else is not. Everything else is created ex nihilo. I think that's probably a pretty safe thing to say about your theology, right?
About any evangelical Christian, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, in fact, most anybody who believes in creeds pretty much goes for that, right?
Right.
Everything I remember, and obviously these are things that Mormonism has sort of questioned or just rejected outright. Everything that exists in the universe is created by God ex nihilo, meaning out of nothing. Sort of what we like to snarkily say got poofed into existence. And that's accurate for certainly for evangelicals, right?
Pretty much
I'm
any
guessing.
classical theist,
Yeah.
Muslim,
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Protestant,
Yeah. That's right.
Christians, anything, yeah.
Sure. Okay. Good. And then the last thing. So number three was the kind of on the depravity of man that. And I certainly evangelicals, Protestants, and I think Catholics too. Sort of, I guess there's varying levels of depravity that people that y'all see people as being. But in general, I know at least as a Calvinist, you've kind of told me that you sort of see humankind as being, by nature, just evil and sort of depraved and sinful and wicked. Is that accurate, or is that,
Yeah,
did I
I think
misinterpret
that
that?
deserves nuance, though. Of course, I before pointed you to Ephesians 2, where it talks very negatively about mankind as children of wrath, and first couple of verses of chapter 2 Ephesians just, I think, a really good summary of how I would view mankind. But I don't think that by believing in total depravity, someone has to believe that everything humans do is evil in and of itself. And I don't think that it means, I mean, I there's different types of belief in total depravity. I, for instance, would not believe that my one-year-old John, when he cries, it's out of utter selfishness and conceited.
Right.
What I would say, though, is that there's a fundamental nature within him that is, you know, that he had at birth, that is growing it's like a seed, and I mean, it's bringing forth death within him, and it's so serious, so thorough, that he in and of himself does not have the ability to embrace the gospel or Christ, and he and most importantly does not have the ability to live a life of good works that would be in relation to a worship of God. And this is a big thing, I think, for people to understand, is that people do all sorts of great things out of natural affections, out of maybe a love for human and other humans. I don't think you have to be, I think pagans love their children in many ways, but I think the only kinds of works that God is really interested in are those that flow out of a right relationship with him. And so if we try to love our neighbor but reject what God is and who he is, then it's filthy rags anyway. But yeah, I agree. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, okay, well, that's useful. You say some things there, and actually it always brings up questions. I'm glad you have you in person, because I always forget to ask them in person. I'm curious, you were saying that you're one-year-old, and I actually have, my youngest has just turned 3 and just got potty trained, actually, so we're rocking and rolling here.
M&M.
In fact, and my oldest is, my oldest turned 10, so now I have a built-in babysitter, too, so
wow.
We're rocking. Now we're really rolling out here.
You see a movie now.
Yeah, it's really sweet, because when you have, we have more than multiple kids, babysitting can get expensive. But anyway, we're off topic. You mentioned this about, for instance, John is not nearly as depraved as he's going to grow into, I guess, on your theology. I'm curious we've talked about who you think is going to hell, and you kind of mentioned pagans. And I assume by pagans you mean anyone who hasn't accepted Christ in the way that your theology.
Well, the way I just used it was someone who is uncivilized, out in the middle of nowhere, who...
All right, so that's not me then, right? You're not, when you say pagan, you weren't applying any.
Well, the term, it can be used in different ways, and so I of course think it's pagan to believe that God has a wife, but I mean, I don't really use that term a lot because there's a lot of baggage with it. So,
right, I see what you're saying. So in that sense, you just meant sort of like Aborigines or something.
Well, yeah, I mean,
or whatever.
I was just trying to paint a picture of someone who you might associate normally with depravity, people who are giving themselves over to orgies and some sort of weird cultures and people who, I don't know. I mean, that's an extreme, I guess. But even the worst of people on Earth have natural affections for people, and they have things that we humans would call good. But that itself is not a contradiction for evangelicals. It's not a
You're saying you're saying Hitler can kiss a baby too, is what you're saying, right?
That's right. Hitler could have been a great philanthropist, and Bill Gates
can be a
great philanthropist, but unless someone's doing that as part of a relationship where there's this passionate worship for who God is, then it's nothing in the end.
Okay. And that gets me past at least that point for now. I might ask more on that question later, but with regard to John, maybe I'm jumping ahead. I'm just curious what you think about the salvation of children, when it comes to this accepting Christ. Are all children saved? So, obviously, Latter-day Saints believe that all children are not only saved, but will be pretty much exalted, particularly if they die before the age of 8 is sort of the magic number for us. And I just don't know where evangelicals see children who die ending up. Do you have a...
I can preface that really quick by acknowledging that I think when Joseph Smith, I think around the origins of Mormonism. I think Joseph Smith had a bad taste in his mouth for a lot of crazy debates that were going on within Christendom, at least where he was. And I think there were people who were arguing that infants could end up in hell somehow. And I've maybe met two people my entire life who are evangelicals who believe that. Everyone else that I know, just by default, believes that if somebody has mental retardation, if somebody's mentally handicapped, if someone dies as a child, a good example, I think we look back to, I think David, the prophet Nathan told him in, I hope I'm getting the story right, told him that his baby was going to die. David took solace in the fact that he would go to where his boy was. I'm not telling this, I need to go back over it so I get the details right. Sure. But I completely believe that if my boy were to die tonight, I would have the same sort of assurance that he's going to be in the presence of God, the same kind of assurance that Latter-day Saints have, because I know that's, let me ask, correct me if I'm wrong, but Latter-day Saints believe as well that when a baby dies that they are going to go to the celestial kingdom. I've read that anywhere. On lightplanet.com or something.
Yeah. No, that's good. I mean, that's good. That's a shared belief, and I think that's great. I just wasn't certain, mostly because we've been having all these conversations. To me, you know, it's specifically about this hypothetical Buddhist peasant woman and her, theoretically, her children or something like living in China, which, you know, this, based on what we talked, well, I should go through the list again, but because that's number 6 and 7 on my list.
Can I insert something?
Sure.
One important thing I think to recognize is that when Christians, and by that I mean evangelical Christians, when they say that infants will go to heaven, we assume there's a grace behind that. We also assume that there's just some special mercy there, that although this baby was born with a sinful nature, he did not flesh it out with his conscience actively. And from what I've read about this subject in Mormonism, the reason that an infant would go to the celestial kingdom, most assuredly, was that he had already proven himself sufficiently worthy in the premortal life. So it seems to – even that doctrine, when you contrast it between evangelical Christianity and Mormonism, even that has huge – there's just huge difference there because of the merit system that we talked about before. I'm sorry if that's going too off topic, but
no, it's not. I mean, I guess I can respond to that to say that actually there's certainly no scriptures that give any explanations as to the why, except for that the grace of Christ covers for them. Now, but there have been speculations that say that certainly, yeah, certainly some people because of a passion for free will in the libertarian sense that Mormonism holds to, and therefore that tends to lead to ideas of merits. But so I'm sure that's why people have speculated on that. But I can say that there is no settled answer to that question. The answer is we don't know. But
that would be kind of weird, though, in the system of Mormon theology to have somebody end up in the celestial kingdom not having merited anything really. And to be there.
Yeah, no, I agree. No, I think that's what pushes those speculations. And
okay.
So, yeah, I think that probably is what drives behind some of the guesses people make. There's no doubt about it. But there's lots of things, obviously, that I guess we couldn't call anything official other than, you know, certainly folklore with some of those things. And I just don't know for sure.
Okay.
But yeah, that's a good point. So depravity, though, is generally a difference. So Mormonism. I mean, the most famous of the Mormon hymns is a childhood hymn that says, "I am a child of God. He has sent me here." And we take that, you know, really seriously, as in, you know, the same type and kind
nature
that God really is. Yeah, same fundamental essential nature as God, and so that we're actually essentially good, and that coming to the earth into our fallen nature is what, you know, it's the flesh that's the problem, not our spirit. And that our spirits are trying to overcome the flesh, and they're at contrast with each other, I guess would be one way to look at it. So,
okay.
So yeah, there's no doubt that there's a difference, because total depravity from Tulip is You know, in some ways, you mentioned Joseph Smith. I think in some ways you're right. A lot of the questions he asked probably were because he found particularly Calvinism so objectionable. Much of Mormonism, probably. A lot of the things when he asked God questions, it seems like the answers were sort of directly contradicting Calvinism, it seems to me. So so I can understand why Calvinists and Mormons...
He was a good Methodist.
Yeah, he was. He in terms of the creedal Christian denominations, Methodism was his preferred before his revelations. So the fourth thing, and these don't apply to other non-Calvinists, but the four and five I have on my list, and you can confirm them about Calvinism because they don't apply to Arminians, is that God in Calvinism, God chooses to save some people entirely through their grace, which is the unconditional election, right? So
you said that God chooses to save some people by no effort of their own through His
grace. Yeah, no effort of their own, right? Okay. And that's what Calvinists call unconditional election. Is that?
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, sure.
I cringe when I read that, and I have sympathy for people who write it that way. And if you qualify it or if you say it in a certain sense, I would agree with it. But I think one thing people might be thinking when they read that is that apart from any faith, apart from any subsequent obedience, apart from any sort of heart change, apart from any life which bears witness to the Holy Spirit doing His extraordinary work, a person can still end up in heaven and this grown adult. And I think a really quick way I like to say it is God has unconditionally elected to render certain that the conditions for salvation be met. So God has conditions for final salvation, like faith, like the evidences of faith. But the unconditionality of things isn't so much that those conditions aren't to be met, is that they will most certainly be met. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I understand. It's sort of a compatibilist view of the universe, where basically what you're saying is that a fixed future, basically that the fixed future of someone who's, God knows who's going to get saved and who's going to hell before they're born is the idea, and He just happens to know that they're going to, do whatever it is to accept Jesus in the right way or whatever it is that you guys, however you say it. And so that's kind of what you're kind of mentioning. And again, as someone who believes in libertarian free will, I sort of think that there's a severe logical problem there that that if it's going to happen, and then it's hard to consider someone morally. It's hard to understand how anyone could be moral in doing something that they really can't not do. Even though because God's put the conditions in place that it's going to happen, whether they would have chosen it or not, I guess.
I'm very familiar with that objection, and I two quick points. I think, as a side point, that was the very objection that Paul was responding to in Romans 9. I think it's verse 19. And another thing was, I think what I said earlier was really a response to people saying, well, if God's unconditionally elected His people, then why do any works? Why do any evangelism? Why even believe? Why obey? If it's all
right,
just...
Sure. But, sure, that's what the Arminians ask you, right?
But, and then my response is, well, those, like the necessary condition of faith and the necessary instrument of evangelism are as necessary as ever, but God is over that, making sure it all happens. So if someone's going to get saved, if a nail is going to end up in the wood, God is going to make sure that He's going to render certain that the hammer hit the nail into the wood. It's not just going to magically appear. I mean, unless it's extraordinary and abnormal. But does that make sense? Does that help?
I understand the arguments. I still think they're incoherent, but I'll explain why. When I get to number five.
Okay.
The number five is connected because it says the saved are predestined to salvation and the damned are predestined to damnation. And so that becomes a problem. If God wants you, when you say God wants the nail to go in the wood, the more important question is, if God wants Jeff Johnston to go to hell, I can't stop it. I can't accept him. If I become an evangelical Christian, I'm still going to hell if he wants me to go to hell. I have no say in it personally. That's the problem with predestination in general. If, you know, even if, you know, even in your theology, no matter what religion I converted to, or whether I stayed a Mormon, whether I became an evangelical, that if I am predestined, nothing I can do can change it. And likewise, if I'm predestined, or you, or anyone is predestined to heaven, in such a scheme, and this is, and by the way, I'm saying the exact same things that other evangelicals say who happen to be Arminians and not. So this isn't a Mormon versus evangelical question. This is an Arminian evangelical, you know, Arminian versus Calvinist objection.
And on so these specific points, yeah.
So on 4 and 5, that's the problem. Is that I very much agree with the Arminians. Is what it boils down to. And so
maybe
that's
even
really
the Pelagians too.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, Calvinists are, of course, Calvin kind of was the theological offspring of Augustine, and Augustine beat Pelagius in the political fight for, you know, for this theology thing. Pelagius thought that we had free will in a very robust sense. Augustine decided that.
Now, I'm not sure how political that was, but you're totally right. I mean, a lot of people point this to Calvin when it's, you know, Luther, I've read, was way more public and forthright about his Augustinianism. And he was an Augustinian monk. And, you know, of course, points back to Augustine. And I think one thing that I've already said might be pertinent here, and it's something that you said. You said that even if I convert to evangelical Christianity, if I'm elected or if I'm predestined to damnation, I'm still going to hell. I think, though, that might, and tell me if I'm reading you wrong, but that might indicate maybe a misunderstanding, because the way I see it is if you're predestined to go to hell, you will never convert to evangelical Christianity.
Exactly. You'll never. That's always I understand. That's a standard compatibilist answer, is that you won't even want to because you get what you want. And so the problem is, of course, then my wants aren't really mine. Somebody else or some prior state of events. Whether, you know, scientific view of it is that, you know, everyone is causally determined, and that we're all part of the great causal chain. Everything we want and feel is actually created, you know, is causally determined by prior states of events. But, you know, the religious version of that is that predestination is that God causes our wants and desires. So either way, I'm just a puppet on strings, and so if I go to hell, it's God's fault. You know,
I think
Calvinism.
Though, and I hate doing this, like this endless nuancing, but I think, though, that something that's really difficult for us Calvinists to communicate is that word cause. To say that God causes all things and is the primary cause of all things, it doesn't mean we can affirm, but we do that apart from, we qualify it, and we say, well, he does no violence to the will. He has a way of ordaining the sins of humanity without doing any sort of direct violence to the will of a man's heart. And so he has a way of, and so the picture people paint of, I think what do you call it, a puppeteer who's controlling a puppet, that paints a picture of direct cause, of a physical cause. And so that's difficult, because even as a Calvinist, I acknowledge that the causation going on is not physical. Ultimately, this is a spiritual issue. The heart, but I don't understand the mechanics of the soul. I don't know how the heart ultimately works. I think, you know, whether you're a libertarian free will adherent or you're a compatibilist, you have some pretty serious philosophical mystery to work with, and I'm okay with that as long as is what I believe is scriptural. And so I understand the objection that, you know, your wants really
are the free will of folks. Yeah, where the free will and Arminians are coming from. So, I mean, this is,
yeah,
like I
go
said,
ahead.
This is something that happens within evangelicals. So I totally, so maybe it's off topic for here since we're doing Mormons and evangelicals, but, and this is something that could be had. This is the same debate that could be had among evangelicals. So let me just say that among evangelicals, I think the Arminians have a right.
Okay.
Calvinists.
Right,
I just can't comprehend, you know, and all the explanations seemed totally incoherent to me. But you know, there's a lot. I don't know how many people, but it seems to be a growing number of people seem to be going back to this predestined. You know, before you're born, you're going to hell or heaven. And you know, and there's no real free will inside the person to change it. God has knows or causes or something causes, but we can't get out of our fate, and that's, to me, just a horrifying thought for me personally. But again, so Arminians, you know, may agree with me on that. But moving on to the things that maybe do apply to Arminians and Calvinists both, and this one's the part that maybe scares me the most about some of the creedal views of God, and it's probably because I have a much more universalist view of things. Number six was the way to get saved is by accepting Jesus, and only the narrow way prescribed by evangelicals. This is sort of what I'm hearing from some of the folks at your site. That's why some of the folks there say, yeah, most Catholics are probably going to hell forever, along with most Mormons, and certainly Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs. You know, many billions of people are going to hell forever. And seven is connected. Anyone and everyone who's not saved in this narrowly defined way will suffer an eternity burning in hell. And so that, to me, is by far the biggest qualm I have theologically. This idea of the Christ that I read about in the New Testament doesn't match up the view of the person who creates people out of nothing, puts them in situations where they can never be saved, and then burns them in hell forever. And not just some people, 98% of the world or 95 or whatever the number, you know, some giant percentage, you know. So that to me is the primary issue, and I think it applies to Arminians and Calvinists alike. Although there may be some more liberal Arminians who have, you know, more liberal view of that, but maybe you can explain that.
One thing that I've wanted to ask you, Jeff, is your view of humanity. One premise that I have is that humanity deserves it. That grace by its very nature is not obligatory, and if God did not want to extend grace to us, he wouldn't have to. And if he wanted to extend grace to one person of 6 billion living people, he would still be God, he would still be just, and he would be completely within his rights to do so. And so I guess my question is, you know, what if, hypothetically, God didn't save anyone, and he gave everyone what they deserved? What's your view of that? I mean, go ahead.
Well, you know, I guess in that view, that would not be a morally commendable God. Nothing, it wouldn't be worthy of anyone's worship if that were the type of person it is.
Why not?
You know, it would be, to me, it would just be a sadist, you know, this horrible monster of a, it'd be more like we view Satan to me if there was a person who didn't want us, you know, who didn't love us at all and did nothing, lifted no finger to keep all humanity from eternally burning in hell. God is worthy of our worship because of his characteristics, his great love for us, you know, for all of us, and his great sacrifice for all of us. That's what makes him moral and commendable to us. You know, that's what makes him worthy of our emulation. You know, if there were such a God who burned 98% of the people or 95% of the world forever in hell, despite, you know, even though they had zero chance, you know, what if we all copied that example? I mean, we would all be sadists ourselves. I just don't get it. You know,
maybe this will help. I mean, just for the sake of the conversation, before we can we like put off the topic of what actually will happen to humanity, which is important. I want to talk about that, but for a second, talk about, you know, what humanity. I guess maybe I didn't get an answer. I mean, does humanity deserve?
Oh yes.
Wrath.
Oh right. So yeah, absolutely. I kind of tried to mention that in passing before, but yes, I have a very high view of humanity. Humanity is like God to begin with. That is humanity is by nature good. Our spirits are good. Our spirits are the same kind as, you know, we're the same kind and type as God Himself and Jesus.
So if God were
I view us as being worth. Yeah. So it's a very different thing. Yeah. Well, I don't view humanity as being depraved. Okay. By nature, certainly spiritual nature. I think that the scriptures make it clear that the flesh and our mortal condition pushes towards depravity. You know, that is clearly a major difference in theology. You know,
I know that's important and it's relevant to what I asked, but as humanity has behaved, I mean, even with your view of libertarian free will, and as humanity has behaved, do you think that God would be just in meting out eternal punishment to every grown adult on the earth?
Okay, so think about what you asked, though. When you say how they behave, do you mean to one another?
I mean the two greatest commandments in terms of...
Yeah, sure. So you're saying people haven't always loved each other. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, right? Is that and people sometimes are cruel to each other.
I'm asking you, really, have people been bad enough collectively as humanity to warrant the meting out of eternal punishment?
Oh, no, absolutely not. No, I mean, you can be... Let's say you were cruel to someone for 20 years and then you died in a car crash. Is that worth 50 billion years to start for the first, you know, of burning? You know, why would even... I don't even understand why God would even keep that soul in existence. If he can poof it into existence, why wouldn't it be more just to poof it out rather than, you know, torture it forever? I just don't get that theology.
One thing that I would agree with you, and I don't want to patronize or just sort of be squishy, but I agree with you in one sense that it's emotionally hard to swallow, and I would agree that I would say that as Aaron, as me, I have not my I would not say that my heart 100% agrees with it, in the sense that I emotionally I haven't swallowed that all, and I'm still looking for God to help me understand how this punishment corresponds to the sin. And I have these general, though, these what I think are scriptural ideas that inform this. And it's one is that, you know, one quick example. I mean, you can do a lot of crimes, you know, just as humans that last 20 minutes, and that would warrant 40 years in jail. So I...
Well, sure. Yeah, I understand.
The time difference isn't necessary. And I think that one thing that is pushing me is who you sin against, the value of the being you're sinning against, I think corresponds to the degree of heinousness of the crime. So I mean, when we murder another human being, that's awful, because you're I mean, like, you know, when Cain, I think he was promised that no one would kill him. And he was, I think it was God who told him that if anyone is, you know, sheds the blood of a man, his blood will be shed too, because they're created in the image of God. And so the value of that human being had a lot to do with the seriousness of the punishment that corresponded to the crime. I would likewise say the infinite value of God is something that informs my sense of justice. Now, in terms of Scripture, that just seems to be the plain teaching. The eternal punishment, the eternal destruction, the lake of fire, you know, tormented day and night forever and ever. This is all scriptural language that I don't know how to get away from. I really don't know how to, in good conscience, that really is the... I think if I was without the Scripture, I, as a fallen human being, would not come to this conclusion. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah,
is important because it's a premise. You know,
it's kind of the core. Yeah, it's my core objection to what, you know. And here's what I think. First of all, I think most evangelicals don't believe what their theologians teach in terms of this. I just don't. You know, I think most would say, "No, God isn't that cruel." That's just not how I see God. So I think that, you know, the lay members, just like in Mormonism, you know,
I don't know very many evangelicals who deny the eternal punishment. I really don't.
You don't think they're... Well, yeah. So the question is, who gets it? You know, I think that what you're describing maybe
well,
a
not
larger
actually,
number.
And that's a distinct question from who should get it.
I'm
going
right.
to heaven forever, but I deserve to go to hell, and that's
forever.
Really a foundational issue. Is what do people?
Yeah, well, that's true. So, and that's another question. Since I'm guessing, because here's why I'm guessing, because it's so counterintuitive. Everything inside us tells us that's not right. That's evil. To have punishment that doesn't fit the crime, and so I hear two things from you. One was you said it's super evil to treat humans badly, super evil, and to murder a human is unconscionable because of the great value of humanity.
Right.
And yet, I'm hoping to see the problem is that you're describing a God who will send 95% to 98% of all humans to burn and be tortured forever and give them no chance to get out of that. Now, so you see the contradiction that I'm seeing here? I mean, first you're saying humans are very valuable and that we have to treat them really super nice, and then you're describing a God who sees them as depraved, awful, and that he sends 98% of them to hell forever and saves a few of them just because he feels like it. You know, that's problematic logically. I mean,
I'm not sure if you read this comment on the blog. I noted that if God were to come down to humanity and sit us all down and say, you know, you have some pretty big sin issues, but I think some group therapy will really work this out and fix your problems. I kind of joked about that because that would be an instance of God really devaluing human beings as something less than morally responsible, morally culpable agents with moral faculties and moral you know, we have this responsibility as humans created in the image of God, and we have this moral accountability, and that's part of why we are so valuable as persons, self-aware persons. And if God were, well, here's the big thesis: if God were to give, you know, excluding this issue of mercy, which I think is, you know, is a good topic, but this is more foundational. I think this topic of justice. If God were to simply not mete out punishment in correspondence to the crime, which itself corresponds to the value of the human and its moral responsibility. I think God would be devaluing human beings as responsible moral agents if he did not give them what they deserve. And of course, that's why Jeff, one more thing. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the whole flavor and the whole portrait of what grace is to me is made to look so awesome because of what I think humanity, including myself, deserve. So the greater the justice I deserve, the greater grace I need. And so this is really relevant to me. But I want to give the mic back to you. Go ahead.
Well, there's a few things. First of all, the grace you're talking about seems to me to be the grace of the Godfather, because in the sense that he likes his friends and he hates everyone else, you know, and he'll be kind to those that he chooses, and then he'll burn everyone else and torture everyone else. And so that doesn't sound very gracious to me based on the numbers I'm looking at. I just can't I see this and other people don't, and perhaps you can explain it to me, but I did want to address the second part, and that you mentioned three or four times in just now about how we're morally accountable and morally responsible, and I would hold that if we don't have free will in the libertarian sense, we are neither morally accountable nor morally responsible because we do not have the real ability to choose anything otherwise. I mean,
it's a huge issue that I don't have an answer for. I mean, I know it's really frustrating for outsiders, but I simultaneously hold that God's ultimate will is irresistible, and I also hold that we're morally accountable. And I think that really goes back to the Romans passage where it, you know, culminates, I think, around verse 19. Paul says, "You will say to me then, why does he still find fault? For who can resist his will? But who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Will what is molded say to its molder, why have you made me like this? Has the potter no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for dishonorable use? What if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction in order to make known the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy, which he has prepared beforehand for glory?" I read that and I see Paul addressing this issue of, hey, God still finds fault in human beings, and yet his will is ultimately irresistible, which he showed in verses 14 to 17 particularly verse 17 and 18 with the Pharaoh. And, you know, and so it kind of looks like, well, Pharaoh's getting a raw deal here. He's ultimately not able to resist God's ultimate sovereignty, and yet he's still being morally held accountable for these evil things he's done. How is that going to work out, Paul? And Paul doesn't answer the question. He just leaves it hanging, and all I can do at this point with Scripture is just shut my mouth and say, I can simultaneously hold that men are morally accountable and that men are, you know, anyway. But I mean, I think that's a somewhat different issue than this broader issue of, do humans deserve eternal punishment? Do we deserve the wrath of God? And I think that's really relevant to how you move on to these issues of grace. I think, and just one observation, Jeff, is I think that you and I have very different. I mean, this isn't me as a Calvinist speaking. This is me just as an evangelical Christian speaking with Arminians. I think we have a very different view of justice than Mormons and what humanity is like and what we deserve. And so the idea of most of humanity going to hell is not unjust. And the idea that God would come and save us as a free gift is all the more extraordinary and amazing.
Well, you know, here's the problem. When you say the problem with that sentence to me is the us. You know, the us is a lot of white European descendants and maybe a lot of South American converts. But really, the us doesn't include most of Asia, the Middle East, certainly until last few decades. You know, most of Africa. So us, in some ways.
Hey Jeff, I think you're breaking up a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you know, I just don't want the recording to be bad for you.
Oh yeah, sure.
I think it's a little.
So where should I start?
Can I pause it just to make sure my other computer isn't downloading something huge?